come out of the government too. So, by the government, I mean the U.S. government. Okay, so Steve here is doing his job. Right. Okay, so this talk is about the protocols that are used in running a TLD registry. And from the questions I've gotten so far on this, these protocols, I'm trying to key on the protocols. I want to talk about how things are said back and forth. The protocol is a way of talking between two places. This is also common to registrars, but all of my material is pretty much specific to registries. You can ask questions about registrar activities. I will know how they work, but I don't have as much background in some of the day-to-day business issues that are in registrars. So let's start with a registry. A registry, if you go back to the dictionary, a registry is an official list of things. It generally will say this thing is going to be associated with that person. That's a general way that registry is used. Now, in this tutorial, to go from a very general registry term, we're going to go to domain name registry, where we have domain names are things that are registered with people in mind. The next slide. Now, within domain name registries, you can have domain name registries in many different places inside the DNS. Specifically, I'm going to talk about top-level domain name registries, which generally are the registries that you hear the most of within the ICANN context. So what I'm saying here is not specific necessarily to what happens at ICANN, but I'm going to try to tie it back to the ICANN terminology, ICANN activities you'll see this week. So to, first of all, show what other kinds of registries are out there to give you a mind about what registries are. RARs are registries. They don't do domain names. They do network addresses and network routing information and AS numbers. There are protocol parameter registries, and the IANA has a whole lot of those. They list what does a certain number mean for a certain field and a certain protocol. And outside of the internet, there are things like land ownership. You own land somewhere, it's registered. Someone keeps track of who has what plot of land. If you have a car, someone has to keep track of who has that car. License plates are what help people identify the driver of a car, or at least who owns the car. And finally, gift registries are out there too. That's a much more different way. But someone says, I am having a baby, and here are the things I would like to have. And people say, well, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. Again, what gift is kind of associated with the person, so there's no overlap in that. Now, in the DNS tree, we have a couple of different registries of note. At top, we have a root registry, which is the one that's operated within IANA, which is the starting point for just about every DNS action taken. Below that, there are a couple of registries. They all act as TLDs. They are subdivided into different letters. GTLD is a generic TLD. Another version of that is an STLD, a sponsored TLD, which seems to have become less common over the year, but GTLDs are basically business TLDs. They're run under contract with ICANN for the most part. Another kind are CCTLDs, country code TLDs. Again, these are TLDs which in the protocol are the same thing, but their administration is totally at the whim of some other body, and usually the so-called country code they're associated with, whether or not it's actually a country. IDN CCTLDs are also top-level domains that are run under the country code operations structure or manner. But in this case, the IDN infers that the name is not just two letters or two ASCII characters. It's whatever script is being used for that particular country or region. And finally, you have other TLDs. This division here doesn't capture everything. There are a few other oddball ones in there. ARPA is a TLD. That's just a whole address of parameters. It's not really a registry in the sense that you register names there, but it is a TLD also. And below each of these generally are private organizations that can do things. Some TLDs are open for registration and anyone can put a name in there. Some have restrictive rules and some have rules that say no one gets to put a name in here. The name is being held just for some specific purpose. So service level, a service definition of the TLDs. In order to talk about the protocols that a TLD uses, and hence what it's speaking, you want to know who it's talking to, and that's what I want to spend a little bit of time on in this next couple of charts. TLDs will have basically at least three faces to them. First face is going to be those people that are going to register objects in the TLD. If you want a domain name, this is my domain name, I'm going to go pay money and I want it to be in the system. You are what we call a registrant. You're in an ICANN world, you're the registrant of a domain name. Registrants talk to either resellers up in the top, this little box up on top, or strictly to a registrar is the bottom part of the shows. And there's an entire amount, an entire body of works just on the relationship between a registrant, the registrars out there, the registrars and resellers out there that then put the names into the TLD registry. On another side of this, another face of this area is the support given to TLDs to make them a little bit more trustworthy, a little bit more compatible with the environment that they're in. In this case here, I've thrown in something called the data escrow area. This is a place where the data that's being held, the register that's being held inside the registry, is put safekeeping for emergency purposes. And finally, and also down there is the trademark clearinghouse, which lets trademark holders have a say in whether or not names are registered in a way that might be abusive to their concerns. And next, and then the third side of this is the general public. People who don't have anything like a domain name. I've actually never purchased a domain name in my life. I've never been a registrant. I've never actually put anything in the DNS. But I go on the web, and I use web browsers, and I send email back and forth. I'm going to be using domain names in what I do. I type someone's name at a domain name. People like me see the registries through the fact that the registries are going to provide me DNS information. So that's a whole other crowd. Now, this is the crowd that sees this impact of a TLD going bad. If a TLD goes down, this side of their business goes down, disruption happens throughout the internet. This is the side that also contributes no money to this problem here. We're just looking at the information. It's kind of an unusual thing. The registrants are funding these TLDs. They don't see a whole lot of interaction in terms of what has to happen day to day. Those of us who are free riders are making them do all the work. So in this talk, I'm going to talk about these protocols that are arrayed around here, and there's no particular order to the picture and the following grouping. EPP is one protocol that you may or may not have heard of. I'll explain that. I'll explain all of these as we get to them, but I'll just say the names right now. DNS and DNSSEC are two protocols that are mentioned all the time here. There's a WHOIS protocol, which is also gets a lot of talk. Then RDAP, kind of a newer thing. Data escrow, which doesn't really have a name. I just kind of call it what it does. And then the trademark area is another area to talk about. So we'll start with the DNS, the domain name system. The DNS is pretty much the premier protocol in all of this. It's a lookup protocol. It lets you say, I want to know the address of this host, and the host is a domain name. I look it up, I get back the address, and I can go there. It's a query for information protocol. The response will come back all the time. It'll either be the answer, ultimately be the answer, or it'll just be no, there's no such host, or there's no such address, or there's no place to go. It's a fairly significant protocol. It's one of the oldest ones in use. It's not the oldest, but it's one of the older ones. If you spend time like I have building protocols and constructing them and trying to go back and research them, it's really, really, really old. This impacts everything about the protocol. It wasn't built to expand that much. It was built to be very fixed size. Because at the time this was built, fixed size protocols was all we could actually handle. We didn't have a way of handling modern fancy protocols. This has made it very hard to replace the DNS, so we end up suffering with it. But if you look through the history of technology, we have this in many cases. Something was done once, not done correctly, but we've learned to live with it to be just as it is, and that's where the DNS is right now. It is the reason for the registries to exist. Now, I'll follow you, Steve. If you think I'm going slow, just let me know, okay? Right. In terms of resiliency of TLD that's always available, the DNS is the one protocol we talk about. If you look at any of the SLA agreements out there, the service level agreements that are out there, the DNS has to be 100%. There's no excuse for that DNS to ever be out for a TLD. We should be able to have it up all the time. Other components, other things can go down for a while. The registration system may go down for a while. Some of the other backups may go down for a while, but when it comes to answering people's questions, there's no reason why you can't always have an answer somewhere. Also is the one component where we have no idea how many people are using it. That's the most frustrating thing with dealing with DNS is that I know who's running DNS. I can go through all the TLDs. I can enumerate them. There's only like about 1,000 or 1,100 right now, somewhere in that area. But I don't know how many people are using it because there's just no way. There's so many ways things come into us. Next. In a block diagram form, the orange bubbles show the registrar, which is the external element here, and also IANA. They impact the DNS by the registrar constantly hitting the registration interface, which I'll talk about later, through the registry database, the server which speaks the DNS protocol. IANA in this picture is there because we figure the TLD at one time with them and we just run with it from then on. Components. The DNS is it has a few pieces that I want to talk about. It has an authoritative server. This is a server of DNS information which says, you ask me a question, I'm going to give you back an answer that I was told by the administrator. There's no way this came from anywhere else. It came from the real source, the one true source for this. The second source of answers when you ask a question are something called recursive servers or caching servers or intermediary servers. They're middle boxes, basically. These are servers out there that learn from authoritative servers information and will repeat it back to someone when they ask for it. It's not the authority, but it's a copy of that somewhere. And finally, we have stubs and clients. These are the sides that ask for information. Every computer out there that wants to look at a domain name has a stub of the DNS in it, and it will ask some server, probably a recursive server, that will then ask an authoritative server or if it doesn't know the information. Next slide. And so another way of looking at the DNS and how it affects all of this, between the DNS server in the blue box up on top, DNS to the recursive servers, and then DNS, again, down to the clients out there, with the machines that you have in your hand. Next slide. Now, DNSSEC is the next part of this. Now, DNSSEC isn't a separate protocol. DNSSEC is a very significant addition to the DNS protocol, but it always gets its own set of slides. It's that much work. Because of that intermediate step in there, the DNS system can be very gullible. So we had to come up with a way to secure it in some way, and DNSSEC came out like this. Now, one of the first ways to secure something is to say, well, I'll have end-to-end security. I'll make sure that whoever I talk to through a secure channel, and I know who I'm talking to and back and forth. But that doesn't work for DNS because of the intermediary points. We couldn't do it that way. We had to do something else. Next slide. The history of DNSSEC, it was first proposed as early as 1990. That was the first time that we noticed that there was a gullible part of the DNS. Until 2004, it went through a series of protocol developments and a lot of workshopping for about 5 years, the last 5 years of that time period. One of the reasons it's been working its way through the system is that it was designed, the operators trying to bend it at the last minute before we formalized everything. In 2004, the IETF issued a set of documents defining the protocol. It's been updated a little bit since then. And then for a couple of years, it just kind of just sat there because it's not easy to do this, and there's no real need to do this. It doesn't do something exciting. I've always likened DNSSEC to being seatbelts in a car. Yeah, if you get in an accident, they could save your life, but up to then, who cares about them? No, you're never going to buy a car because it has good seatbelts. No one designs seatbelts. No one decorates their seatbelts. It's not very exciting. This guy, Dan Kaminsky, he's a researcher. He was not an attacker. He was a researcher. Demonstrated how vulnerable the DNS was in 2008 and showed how to attack the DNS from a theoretical point of view, and that spurred a lot of interest in DNSSEC, saying we've got to stop these kind of attacks. What he describes happening is called cache poisoning. I could forge answers and shove them into the DNS protocol stream, and suddenly I could make a resolver give out bad answers for something for quite a long time. DNSSEC took up some steam at that point. In 2009, it first appeared in Sweden. The .se zone, first to roll out a signed zone. By middle of 2010, the root zone was also signed. It's been signed ever since then. Now, the approach that's used is digital signature. I take some data. I take the data that DNS would answer back, and I apply a digital signature to that. I use public key cryptography, which means I send out public keys. You all get a copy of the public key. When I assign something with a private key that only I have, it's a secret known to me, if you can verify that signature over the data, you know it had to come from me. That's the idea of public key cryptography. To make this scale to the global size it has, we use a hierarchy of keys. The key for a piece of data belongs local to that data. It's chained all the way back up to the top of this. There are people who don't like the idea that DNSSEC is a centralized security system, but frankly, it's protecting a centralized naming system, the DNS, so it follows the DNS tree. Now, what a registry has to do, first of all, it has to manage its keys. If you are doing any signing of anything, whether it's PGP, encryption for email, DNSSEC, or SSL certificates, you have to start managing your cryptography somehow. That's a job that's often overlooked, a job that gets fallen off sometimes when someone loses interest in it. but you now are, your job is to manage these keys. The next thing TLDs do is that they have to now accept data from their registrants that are that's DNSSEC applies to DNSSEC. In this case, they call it the DS record, which is just a particular record in the DNS that sent up the chain. The TLDs have to sign these records, to sign the DS records, and publish that. And next bullet I have up there, the next to last bullet up there, signing negative answers. That sounds kind of simple, but in the DNS, it's actually kind of hard because in typical old-time DNS, when there's no answer for what you want, I would send back an empty message. You ask for something, you get back nothing. Can't sign nothing. So you have to sign something. So we had to create something to sign, and that something has been contentious over the years. Finally, as the TLDs, when they start managing their keys, have to make sure the IANA, one step up, knows keys they're using or else the chain of trust will get broken. And in the bubble diagram again, the registrant sends in information to the DNSSEC functions part of a TLD. The IANA root registry is also interacting with that function there. It goes to the registry database to populate the database, which is the registry of all domain names and their information, down to the server and out is DNSSEC. And this week, there are two sessions dedicated to DNSSEC that you might want to look at. Later today at 5:30, about 3 hours from now, there's a DNSSEC for everybody, a beginner's guide that's going to happen in right here. Don't go anywhere. And then Wednesday, there is a much longer session, about 6 hours, of more talks about DNSSEC workshop. Again, it's right here, so don't go anywhere the next 2 days. You wasted your hotel rooms the next 2 nights. You're going to be here until then, right? Next. The protocol. WHOIS is a protocol. It's older than DNS. It was necessary at the start of the internet because when you put a bunch of unreliable pieces of software and hardware together, which is what this wall was in the 70s and the 80s, you had to be able to call up somebody on the telephone system, which then was actually working really well, and say, I can't get to you. What's going on? Because you don't know if a problem is going to be at your end, at their end, or somewhere in the between to work out this way. So in the sense of a day when everything was funded by a certain set of agencies, research across a couple of universities, there was no money riding on this thing, no enterprises, no investment, just a bunch of researchers out there. You had to know everybody for this to work because we're building in a virtual world. The WHOIS protocol, a very simple question and answer. Again, there was no concerns at all about security, privacy, or whatever at the time. The protocol definition is pretty much what's on this slide here. You open a TCP connection to a certain port number. 43 is the number for that. You send a question. You wait. You get back an answer. You then close the connection and you print the answer to the screen. There was nothing at all said about what the question was, nothing said about what the answer is going to be. And the way that fits here, the registry database feeds the WHOIS server. The WHOIS server then speaks WHOIS out to the clients. Now, why is there a problem with WHOIS? Well, questions and answers are undefined. When you're trying to write software, you can't really design to whatever. It's very hard to write whatever. It's very hard to parse whatever. Freeform is not good for interoperability out there. If you ask one registry for the information about a domain name and say, who's the owner? It might say, well, no one owns them here. The person who's currently holding it is this, as opposed to the organization, the administrative. All the terms that are being used for someone having the name could be used. Another biggest problem back then was that everything was in ASCII. It was assumed that only ASCII was involved here, so there was no internationalization time. Now, for someone who's trying to manage a system, this first protocol assumed that all of the information was in one server out there. Something knew everything about everybody. We have no way to redirect you saying that, I only know about this part of the namespace, go over there and ask somebody else. The DNS does that natively, but it wasn't in WHOIS. The idea of differentiated access, that's the idea that law enforcement may want to have more access than the general person out there, or that I may not want to give any access out to this for certain kinds of. None of that exists in the WHOIS protocol. There was nothing at the client end that could support any of that. And there was no means at all to validate the data inside these answers. Whatever was registered there was registered as is. In fact, over the years, as people have been trying to clean up the WHOIS area, find even basic postal address structure was not followed in many places, where you may have someone listing their town, but not their province and not their country or not postal code. And in some cases, I've actually gone through some WHOIS data in the past, and I found two domain names. The only thing common between the two of them was the mobile phone number, tied to the same person. They same building, same place, but they put it in different ways. You couldn't tell the mobile phone number was anything that was common between the two. And WHOIS, despite being the oldest thing out there, it has two sessions. You notice DNS had no sessions. We're done talking about that, apparently. WHOIS has WHOIS Review Team International Registration Data Expert Working Group that meets. Time travel is required for this. It met yesterday, so forget about that one. When I gave the talk last time, it was the same time as my talk. Now it's in the past. And then also the thick WHOIS policy implementation meeting is Wednesday morning, 8 to 9, and that's somewhere else. You don't have to stay here for that one. Next. Okay, so EPP protocol. Now, first I'll say that DNS and WHOIS have been around forever in the registration game. DNSSEC predates EPP, kind of. But EPP came along about 15 or 16 years ago. It's what we call a business-to-business protocol, meaning that this is a protocol that not everyone does. DNS, WHOIS, everyone out there does those protocols. WHOIS if you care about something, DNS because you're using any other application out there. But EPP is usually done only between two people who are doing business about the registration of domain names. Its purpose is to edit the register. Date names, update information about names, transfer names between two places where it gets kind of complicated, and any other maintenance. It could be account information. Plus, it's extensible. It does everything else you want to do in the registration game involving business policies, retrieving stuff, and so on. Next. The history of it, between 2000 and 2003, it was developed in the IETF. It was spurred on from some of the work being done in VeriSign with CommonNet back in those days. They had a previous protocol called RRP. This was a improvement on that EPP done and encouraged to support the shared registry model that ICANN has been following for so long. Between 2003 and 2009, within the IETF, it went from being a proposed standard or a basic standard, the earliest form of standard, to being a full, complete standard in their naming system. It has been mandated for GTLDs and the sponsored TLDs by ICANN. It's in all the contracts. I believe all of the TLDs that ICANN oversees does it, but there may be one or two that haven't gotten in there yet. I just don't know about a few of them. Now, as far as CCTLDs, which are not, they don't answer to ICANN or anything like this, they have been adopting it. Many of them have seen it as a good idea and have brought it in-house, and they've been developing on that for quite a long time now, so that at this point, he truly is a standard protocol from the IETF doing a very generic function, whether it's the ICANN world or outside of the ICANN world. Currently in the IETF, there's a working group that's been spun up again because in the 2000s, there was a bit of a spread in the way it was extended, and people lost track of how to do it correctly. The IETF thought it was time to bring them back together and let's reduce the number of extensions and try to keep things more common. It doesn't stop people having different extensions for the same idea that still exists. But now there's a working group there trying to encourage a more common way of going forward, whether or not it's the ICANN model, the ICANN-regulated model of TLDs, or is the CCTLD doing what it wants to do. EPP doesn't have to be the exclusive way of updating a register. Many TLDs will have other ways to put things in there if they're allowed to. Sometimes you're required to do EPP, but you don't have to do EPP. Just one way to change what's in the database. And the architecture here, EPP uses a very strong transport layer, a secure transport layer. It's done in XML, then extensible markup language, which is kind of an older way of writing these protocols. You have to write a client for it, along with the server out there. It's the way things were done. When this was minted, this protocol was made. This is the way people like to do protocol. The server is inside the registry. It's that middle blue bubble there, and it speaks it to the registrar out there on the outside. That's how we update the databases. Next. RDAP. Oh, by the way, if you have any questions, go ahead whenever you want to. Steve will watch for hands because I didn't get that far. Anyway, at the end, we can also do questions too. Because frankly, going through I call this a laundry list presentation. I'm going through one protocol after the other one. after about four or five, they get really boring to do this because they're not related to each other. So it's not like a long story. So if you feel you want to break it up with a question about, so I had some. RDAP. RDAP is a registration data access protocol. No domain name registry I know of, though there may be some, uses this right now in operation. It is, there are places operating this in the RARs. It's a new thing. It's a query response protocol to look at what's in the registration database. And if you're paying attention, that's the same thing that Whois is. Basically, when you're registering stuff in the database, you want to ask what's in there. The DNS is bored from it. Whois and RDAP lets you ask, what do you know about something? Because sometimes names are registered, but not in the DNS. I can register a name for the purpose of blocking it from being in the DNS. I may have more registrations than actually delegations in the DNS. Now, RDAP had a couple of goals to meet in its design of the last couple of three or four years in the ITF. I want to be able to ask any server and then essentially be led to where the answer is going to be. I want to be able to go from server to server. And it's also very interesting that this protocol was developed not for domain names. That domain names were not the first thing to be put into RDAP. The RARs started this. Numbers were the first thing that went in. Numbers, IP addresses, and AS numbers were the first to go in. All of this protocol sits on top of HTTPS, secure web transport, basically. Whois, I said, you connect to port 43. You may hear 43 Whois. That's native Whois for those who did it for a long time. There's port 80 Whois, which is you ask the Whois question over a web interface. But those two, that's just a front end for the Whois client. RDAP doesn't have a port number. It rides totally on top of the web. It's part of its web technologies. You go to a web server, it just gets handled internally as a URL. Next slide.
But just to clarify that, the HTTPS has a port number. So
yes.
It's inheriting the,
whatever that is,
the
yeah.
port that this other protocol is using, right?
Right. Yeah, okay. And actually, that number is 443. That 443 and the 43 are not at all, it's coincidental that they were there. Something people might want to read into that, but they had nothing to do with each other. Components of RDAP is a server. It's software to parse the queries. It looks it up in the database, and it prepares a response. That's all it does, pretty much. Client is a web API. It's a web browser. It can basically just following what the web browsers already do. The important thing here is that clients in RDAP, as opposed to Whois, the clients are smarter. They can do things. They can support authentication. They can say, I have a certificate proving I am who I am, and I'll present it to you for whatever purpose. Now, the history of RDAP, where it started from, there was dissatisfaction with the Whois, which we all know about. We've probably heard about that. Two of the RARs out there said, let's do a web-based approach. They actually tried a few approaches that didn't work so well, but they finally get one that was really successful. So whenever you get into RDAP, if you start looking at this protocol any deeper, you're going to see a lot about the RARs, the numbers side of this, the IP addresses. And also, you're going to see a lot about the HTTP protocol and the HTTPS protocol. A lot of it is just taken over by that in the lower layer. Next. The query looks like a URL. They just have a way of structuring the query in there. It's a formalized way of giving the query. It's not just a generic answer. It's not a generic question. It's a very structured question. Now, the key, though, is what I ask for can change over time, but I have to define what it is. I can say, this is an address, this is a name, this is a contact. I change it, but I have a fixed number of things in there I look for. It makes it a lot easier to parse this. The response comes back over HTTPS, meaning that all security is taken care of in places like that. They have a bunch of different services in there, retries, all finding answers. They use JSON, JavaScript Object Notation. That's now replaced XML as the way to write things down in the Internet. Again, it's like a Whois in some ways, but it's a formalized way. It's parsable. You can machine parse this. In the old days, when I looked up an IP address and I want to know who had that address, if I went to one of the RARs, I looked up the administrator. I looked up another, it was the owner. Another one was the organization. I had to look for specifically terms that applied to each of the individual RARs. With RDAP, they've said, okay, the person who holds this has this name. This is the label I use for the owner. It makes it much easier for a machine to automatically pick this stuff up. Finally, a formatted redirection message. And again, to use the RAR's example of the Whois, if I didn't know which of the RARs issued the address, I could try any one of them, and they'd say, well, no, it's not mine. It belongs somewhere else. And some of the RARs said, it goes somewhere else. Others would say, go to Aaron for this address. They knew which one to go to. So again, you had to know who you're asking what back. So we have this definition out there. Now, RDAP provides, you don't have to use, but it gives you the choice. Whois didn't let you have a choice? Now, at the bottom, I have a to-do, an operational profile. Protocol is defined a certain way, but it doesn't say you have to run it exactly that way. Right now in ICANN, we're working on the operational profile for those registries that ICANN will oversee. And I know of other CCTLDs are doing their own operational profiles for their specific concerns. So I'll go through this again briefly. I think I've touched on this already. Defined data model makes it a lot easier to handle. Expansion beyond ASCII. Internationalization has been a very big part of this. Uses more of the Unicode below that. Distribution of data, meaning that the data doesn't have to be in one place. I don't assume it's in one place, which has a lot of impact on where data is retained and held. Differentiate access. That refers to whether or not I want to have some data available only to law enforcement. Do I want to have some data that's given out to the general public? What do I want to say to different kinds of people out there? Now, of course, you know, it sounds like a simple little problem, but it gets complicated quickly because, first of all, define law enforcement, right? Each registry that's going to find, who do they consider to be the ones they'll give everything to? Who are the ones they'll give almost nothing to? Who will they, and so on down the line. This has to be worked on. This is part of an operational profile, too. What's going to be done about how people get access to this data out there? It's wide open to many different that. And finally, this is more compatible with current software practices. And the way it looks here looks a lot like Whois. The RDAP client speaks RDAP to the RDAP message handler, which is the information from the database, and the arrow goes one way. Next slide. And this week, there's one session on RDAP. It's Wednesday morning, downstairs, 12:30 to 1:45. Well, they'll be talking about, I presume the operational profile is the main topic there. They may have other topics in there. I haven't seen the agenda. Steve.
I have a question from online, if that's all right.
Sure.
This is from Patrick Miles. He says, Ed, you mentioned RDAP not being used. Why not? Do you see increased usage coming?
Yes. Yes. Right now, the reason why not, for the most part, is people are rolling it out. The RFCs defining it were passed the approvals of the IETF just in December of this year, of last year, so it's like 10 months later. People are deciding that now that I know what it's going to be, I'm going to see, well, how does it my current data model? I know at least the one CCTLD that's been doing this, and I'm right now it's just a matter of software development cycles. It's a matter of making sure they find how they want to roll it out. It's just a matter of the lag of this going out there. Now, in the ICANN world, I know that there's a requirement in the registry agreements that say that when a new place for Whois is ready, TLDs have X number of days to implement it. That clock hasn't started ticking yet. It's not X number of days from the RFCs coming out of the IETF, but after ICANN says we want to roll this out through all the system. And what's happening now is making sure that we break rules in there. So it's coming. It's just a new thing. I'm sorry, Steve. I want to, make sure. Okay. We're okay with that, okay?
I'll get over it. Yeah.
Okay. All right, so moving into the realm of the protocols, which are less fancy, data escrow. The purpose of data escrow is to take a copy of the registration database, which is basically the TLD's source of authority. That's the record of authority. That's the thing that they're building their business on, is that contact list. And you have to put it with a third party, whose job is to take this stuff and store it so no one else sees it unless some conditions occur. Why do this? If the TLD goes under, it fails, someone steps on the database, the whole thing goes gone. Who's going to protect the investments of all the people who have paid money for names that they've now done branding on top of? Where are we going to have the information? So we have to have this somewhere else. This makes the registries have a – this makes people – registering a name, have some confidence that even if the single point of failure here is the TLD, I have another place where my information is being held. Hopefully, from a technologist's point of view, some other operator could say, okay, just give me what's in that escrow, and I can just populate my database and start running right away. That's the hope. It's probably far-fetched, but that's what we'd like to be able to do, is to get things up and running again, because, again, the DNS side of this is going to affect everybody out there, not just the registrants and other parts of the system. Now, stored by a third party, that's pretty simplistic. It's stored with strict rules for access. And in this case, ICANN tells all of its TLDs that are under the agreements that, that say this, you will have an agent that will collect this information. ICANN can get that information if certain things happen, but we also need to have a key to get the information because it's not going to be in plain text, and I'll get to that soon. The history of this, the IETF had a birds of feather on this about 5 years ago, and I was a co-chair of that, so I have a real memory of this. The IETF didn't like it. It was boring. They weren't excited. It wasn't a proposal. It was, do you want to talk about it? Nah, not so interesting. That doesn't mean it's unimportant. It just means it's not technically that interesting to a bunch of engineers that like to do really complex things. It's actually a pretty simple thing. I just want to take this data, put it in encoding, ship it across to someone who will then put it on their database. I want to make sure it gets encrypted. That's probably the most complicated part. Well, actually, it's not the most complicated part. The most complicated part is I want to compress it. I want it to be short because it got these third parties charged by the byte. So I want to make sure that everything's small when it gets there. And that's actually the hardest part of all this. So it's kind of where it comes from. It's fine currently in two... go ahead. In this case, my slides actually matched what I wanted to say. And you... sorry, talk later. So it's defined in two places. If you look for a data escrow in the ICANN world, there are two places that it's defined. Not defined twice. It's just two pieces of definition. There is what looks like an internet draft exists somewhere in the ICANN realm, which describes the framework. It describes how the escrow is going to work. What do you deposit, how, and so on. Secondly, there's the timing of this. When do you deposit this, and how do you deposit this, and so on, is in specification two of the registry agreements, at least for the 2012 round of GTLDs. It says here, the dump of the database is going to be XML version in one or more files. It doesn't necessarily have to be XML for all the TLDs. I know that some of them use form. It's compressed and encrypted so that it's cheap and it's only seen by the appropriate parties. Every day a deposit is made, the deposit being the incremental stuff that's happened and a lot, what names did they sell, what was unregistered that day. And on Sundays, a full dump of everything goes in there, incremental the rest of the week. So this chart here, which unfortunately we didn't do our color scheme right, but the registry operator on the left will send to the escrow agent the keys. The middle arrow says the deposit, whether it's a full or incremental, and it also lets the escrow agent know that this has happened for whatever purpose they need to tell the escrow agent. ICANN also gets notifications from the registry operator saying they've done it, and the public keys are also sent along. The public keys give ICANN the ability to see what's in the escrow agent's, what's being held by the escrow agent. However, just because they have the ability to see it doesn't mean they get it here. The ICANN doesn't have the deposits. They're being locked away in some other place and will only get it if certain other conditions are met, and then ICANN would talk directly to the escrow agent, which I don't show here because I'm talking about the red. Trademark Clearinghouse. This is the last of the laundry list. It's a open... The openly defined way to protect... yes, a question. This is where Steve gets exercise. I like this part.
So I didn't see where the question came from.
Who?
Hello, I am Mona Ailouti. I am from Jordan. I want to ask you about the escrow agent. Is it a sort of a backup?
Essentially, yes. It's essentially a backup. But they're not able to process the data.
Okay.
It's just like backing up your hard drive, but...
So for how long we keep that data that we encrypted and compressed?
Offhand, I don't know. I would assume in this case, they only retain it until the next full. There's no reason, I'm sure they're not contracted for the history. You're saying, you have an idea?
If you corrupted the data and you waited 2 weeks, then there'd be bad data and nothing. I presume it's a couple years.
But I hadn't looked at the detail yet. I'm sure there's retention of some time. I've never looked at that level, but I am aware that there are times when some people will report that they've submitted data, but they've sent an empty file. So there's probably some history kept.
To bring that up to the point, though, that's a contractual agreement issue. It's not there's nothing that technically to say you can only hold that data for 86,400 seconds. That's a contractual deal between whatever parties are contracting, and we specifically are feeling on the technology underneath that. So we don't want to touch the policy. We're trying to be neutral in what the technology is providing. Yeah. Was there another question too, or okay?
Yeah, it's actually there's three layers. There's technology, then there's the contracts, and then there's the policy in this. And the contracts I have not asked for that level of detail, to be honest, before. Because other questions came up, like, well, does the data escrow tell ICANN something? Like, well, I didn't look that up. I'm on to the registries in this set of slides. So, PMCH. Trademark holders had concerns about the opening up of domain names. And again, that's a policy matter, which is what it is. So there was this mechanism put in place to allow trademarks to be given some recognition in the process. And this is actually a pretty involved protocol, and I'm not going to do complete justice to the protocol. I'm just going to talk about the registry side of this right now. There are some good documents out there with really fancy ASCII art, which I admire. You want to look at and hang it on the side of your house sometime. It's a nice tapestry. So I'm going to limit the discussion here to what the registry does in these protocols. And in such of that, I'm going to talk about two of the phases. Now, when a registry starts work under the new TLD program, the 2012 round of applications, there are a bunch of phases out there. And it took me a while myself as someone who's worked in registries for a long time to understand what these phases are. There's the sunrise phase. This is one of the opening phases of this, saying that at this point, I'm going to allow only people who own trademarks to register trademarks within my system. There's a trademark claims phase, which says that if anyone registers a name that matches someone on a certain list, there will be notice of a trademark claim on that name. It doesn't stop anything. It's just a warning that bad things may come to those who don't like them happening. There are other phases. There's early availability phases, there's friends and family phases, there's pre-sale, and then there's general availability, which is what a lot of us are seeing out there. But for the purpose of Trademark Clearinghouse, the sunrise and the trademark claims periods have any significance. Now, this protocol, it's many protocols, it involves many parties. It's built over the secured web protocol, again, HTTPS. Next slide. Sunrise is the offering of TLDs to trademark holders only. The registry supplies to the in Sunrise, the registry will tell the TMCH the list of domain names that are registered out there. The registry receives back a list of trademarks that are no longer listed. So we start out with a list of trademarks that the registry is supposed to protect. And over time, they get taken out as trademark holders are not worried about them anymore. Basically, it's a revocation of names at this point. It goes from a populated list of things I don't want registered down to what I'm going to allow. Next slide. Trademark claims. This is in the early days of the TLD. The registry will tell Trademark Clearinghouse the list of names registered that match, that are close matches to the pre-registered trademarks in there. Coming back from the Trademark Clearinghouse, a list of labels comes back saying, here are the ones to watch out for. That's all that's going back between the registry and the Trademark Clearinghouse. Next slide. And again, to show this in block diagram, up on top, the arrow from mountainside to wall side, I don't go to right or left anymore, says that the service marks revocation list is sent from the Trademark Clearinghouse to the registry. During the claims, the middle arrow, only the domain name list is sent across in that time period. And at all times, the registry is telling the Trademark Clearinghouse, this is what I've been registering, so we can see if we have anything to deal with. And so to quickly wrap up, I don't have a long wrap-up slide. This is basically my slide. These are the protocols that we went through, and again, not in any order. EPP was the extensible provisioning protocol for affecting changes in the register of names that are being held in the TLD. DNS and DNSSEC are the way that the general population of the Internet make use of what's being registered, knowing where to go with information, for information. The WHOIS protocol is the old way that's been around forever, saying, for asking who has this name or this address, let me go find them, knock on the door. RDAP is the new way that's going to come along to do the same thing with the ability to do some more interesting protections of the data. Data escrow is a way to back up your hard drive, basically, in the TLD sense. Trademark protocols are there to protect the interests of trademark holders in the whole registration process of the new TLDs. So, time for questions. time for making Steve run to the back.
Question?
No, in the front. No, Steve, there's one way in the back first. No, here, right here. Second row.
Second row, there.
Yeah. Wait. I just wanted to make you run.
It's confusing the front. No, I'm just would like some clarification on the trademark clearinghouse. Is that an optional protocol? Because most registries, I don't think they're using this, are they? Especially the smaller ones. But I've never heard of that.
I believe that all of the 2012 registries have to use it, in some way. However, when you say most registries, CCTLDs, I think there's one or two that has gotten, it's actually gotten some whiff of interest in CCTLDs because they have the same trademark protections that will eventually hit them. Some of the older ICANN contracted TLDs, I'm not sure if it's filtered to all of the agreements yet, but I'm sure it's being fed into that every time there's a renewal. So, but I think of all the new ones, especially all the smaller new, if you think the smaller ones are, you know, the new ones are smaller, there should be some impact of that. In fact, I believe that all the phases that I was talking about, Sunrise and trademark claims, the only two that actually exist in the agreement, all the early availabilities and everything else, those are their names applied by the DLD for its purposes, but are not contractual requirements.
Any other questions? Oh, we got one back here. Almost in the back now.
Almost, yeah. I'm trying to maximize.
Yeah, thank you. I just wondering about the TMCH. So is it support the internationalized script? Like fully, like all the trademark in Thai, in Chinese, and whatever.
Yeah, I believe in the back, way in the back, I'm getting a thumbs up from our IETF expert saying it certainly does do that. It accommodates all of the IDNA 2008 internationalized concerns and everywhere else that would get involved here. Paul Hoffman, by the way, is our IETF expert. Any other questions? Someone from over there. No, I'm asking for someone from over there. Please raise your hand. Yesterday's room was a lot bigger. You had further to go. Oh,
but you have more people on this one.
Yeah, we have more people.
Great.
Yeah. I see. It works. Right. It works. Now, over there. Start thinking of a question way in the back. Neil?
Go ahead. I'm just asking about the real added value for the trademark and especially for the CCTLDs.
Interesting. I can only give you off the top of my head type of ideas, but if CCTLDs, depending on how the CCTL sees its role in the economy, they may decide they want to offer the same level of protection to trademark holders in their area of concern that, you know, it's being asked of in the ICANN area. Some of the CCTLDs, what I've seen over time I don't want to step on areas I don't want to talk about. As a staff member, I don't want to get into politics and all that. But EPP, I'll give EPP as an example. EPP was a protocol that ICANN pushed on the contracted TLDs a long time ago. CCTLDs there at the time were not necessarily going to follow the ICANN model. But over time, it kind of rubbed off on them. It seemed like it worked for these registries over here. It made their operations a lot easier. So CCTL said, maybe it's such a bad idea to adopt that piece of technology. I can see that analogy applying here where trademark concerns that are being addressed within the ICANN area may be something that the CCTL are realizing, well, maybe we have the same ideas. That's just my thinking. I do see over time a adoption of what's done in the ICANN model by others who are not required to do that.
Just to add to that, I think some CCTLDs use their, some countries use their CCTLDs as a monetization model. And we're looking at Trademark Clearinghouse, and their CC is almost entirely to monetize. Branding, not going to throw any CCTLD out there. Some of them relate to television, the shortened version of television, things like that. There might be a way to improve their market by offering some kind of trademark clearinghouse model within that. And I'm not saying they are, and I'm not saying they're not. I'm just saying that might be one scenario where a CCTLD might embrace and adopt the protocol of trademark
questions. Over here.
Over where?
This side.
I don't believe you anymore.
You know, I'm just being lucky. I'm not making this up. Over here. No, over here. Seriously. Over here.
Oh, my goodness.
See? I'm not making this stuff up.
It's in your head. Wow.
I'm controlling the crowd with my eyebrows.
Hello, my name is Hansa. It's my first ICANN meeting.
Thanks for coming.
I missed part of RDAP. You said that it has no port number. So how it works?
Okay. RDAP is a protocol. The way RDAP is defined is it's a way of using the web. And now web servers today have a couple of port numbers. Like the web is on port 80. If I use basic HTTP, it's port 80. HTTPS is on port 443. So RDAP just uses that. It is already open for web access. If you look, if you try to do any kind of access on your machine, you'll see that it already has a 443 entry in like every firewall because that's all the secure web. So RDAP didn't go off and say, give me yet another port number and it'll connect to that. I'm just going to make a URL, you just use the web, and you get to the RDAP server sitting at that
point. All right, Ed, I'm going to look this way. Who's next?
Who's next? I'm thinking we're almost out of questions. How about online? Another way to make him run. This is how I have my fun. I make Steve run around.
No, I do have Patrick Miles typing, though, so we're going to wait in suspense for just a moment. We all do right. Have an online question. No, he stopped typing.
We're all waiting for Pat right now.
Oh, he is. Excellent presentation, Ed.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I owe you another dollar. Patrick, I mean.
All right. Well, Ed, I want to thank you for taking the time today and yesterday for presenting on the registry protocols. We do have, let's take a moment and thank Ed for a second. We do have another session coming up in about 45 minutes with the root server operators. This is from our root server security advisory committee, RSAC. One of the co-chairs, Johan Lehman, will be presenting about the root part of the DNS and also what the RSAC is doing lately within the ICANN structure. Great turnout yesterday. It was a great presentation, super interesting. So that's at 3:45. And then not our presentation, but after RSAC will be a beginner's guide to DNSSEC in the same room. If you're just getting into DNSSEC, I highly recommend SIC. I am going to beg and plead. We are looking for actively looking for feedback. So if you have a moment before you pack up your laptop, please head over to this URL. We're looking for how well we're doing. We want to keep doing presentations and tutorials like this to bring technology to the community here to help understand what the technology does, help inform the dialogue during the week of discussions. We also working to avoid the diminishing return model, so we don't want to keep doing the same presentation ICANN meeting after ICANN meeting. So any ideas on what we could do, what you as a community member would like to see explained or discussed from a technology perspective, we would love to hear. So before you pack up and run off to whatever meeting you have next, please just take a moment and fill it out, and we would appreciate your input. With that, we will be back on in about 45 minutes, so you have some time. Thanks.